new client and use their very powerful software that is fully capable of mass surveillance in this country in order to find and be able to utilize and make a lot of money in government contracts.
And Makeda, we only have about 30 seconds left, but the significance of Gregory Baratia, a longtime Palantir employee, now being the chief information officer of the entire federal government as of January?
Yes. So something that is coming out of the second phase of DOGE is, sure, Elon Musk may be leaving, but Musk-aligned people from Musk-aligned companies and things like Palantir are finding themselves in very powerful roles in government. The chief information officer was not a very sexy title prior to this administration, but it gives people in these positions have a lot of power over who has access to what data at agencies all across government, whether that is SSA, which has bulks of data on all of us, right? But also the Department of Homeland Security or just, you know, the federal CIO like Barbazia.
McKenna Kelly, we want to thank you so much for being with us, senior writer at Wired. We'll link to your coverage of Palantir and other tech companies at democracynow.org. That does it for our show. We're hiring for a number of positions. Find out more at democracynow.org/jobs. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnock, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamer Riaski, Joe John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood. Special thanks to Safwat Nassal. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
Support for KBOO comes from our members and from the Jazz Society of Oregon, presenting the 45th annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival. Friday, July 18th through Sunday, July 20th at Cathedral Park under the St. John's Bridge in North Portland. Featuring local jazz, blues, soul, and Latin artists such as the Revival Brothers Band, McTuff, Tezetta Band, and more. More information at jazzorgan.org.
Tune in to Cubby Cushy, Cubby Cush, Tuesday nights on KBOO. 2 hours of global bass with an emphasis on South Asia and the South Asian diaspora, and an even more special emphasis on the Punjabi diaspora. Hosted every Tuesday, 10 to midnight, by The Incredible Kid. This ain't world music, it's birth of a new world music.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, after 4 months detained in the Northwest Detention Center, labor organizer Juarez Zeferino has chosen to move back to Mexico for the time being. Wyden introduces a bill that would require ICE agents to identify themselves. And Mel Gertov provides diplomatic critique in the Global Citizen Commentary. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 15, 2025. I'm Eric Leuschner. A well-known labor organizer from Washington, Alfredo Juarez Zeferino, decided to return to Mexico after spending 4 months in detention at the Northwest ICE Processing Center in Tacoma, Washington. Juarez says that this decision has been tough. He said, quote, "It's hard to fight the case from here. Everyone loses. There's no confidence in this court," end quote. He encouraged other people who do not yet have legal status to keep fighting to stay in the United States. Judge Teresa Scala approved Juarez's request to receive voluntary departure. This leaves some options for legal return to the United States later. It requires the detainee pay for their own ticket out of the country and must be by a certain deadline. Juarez's attorney, Larkin Vanderhoof, said that Juarez will likely get sent out on the next plane after his paperwork is filled, and that could be in the next several days or the next week. Vanderhoof says, quote, "He is a fighter, and he wanted to fight. He wanted to be released to his community that he is a part of and in many ways a leader of, but the length of the detention and the conditions that he's in were becoming too much. end quote. Juarez is one case among many that has not been released on bond from the Northwest Tacoma Processing Facility. According to reporting by Street Roots, from October 2022 to 2023, Northwest Immigration Processing Center, or NWIPC, has the lowest chance of an immigration judge granting a bond motion, at just 3% in all cases nationwide. On Monday, July 14th, Oregon State Democratic Senator Ron Wyden introduced legislation that would prohibit Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers, or ICE agents, from concealing their identity while in the process of detaining people or doing other enforcement actions in public. Under the most recent wave of deportations under the Trump administration, DHS, or Department of Homeland Security officers, including ICE agents, have concealed their identity while making detainments and engaging in quote-unquote public enforcement operations. The public is often unable to confirm if they are interacting with legitimate law enforcement or if they are being kidnapped by masked strangers. It leaves possibility for antiquity of identity, which allows law enforcement to not be accountable and to not have to tell their detainees or their family who they are or where they are being taken. Wyden's press release on the issue says, quote, "It makes a high-stress situation worse." The act that Wyden has introduced is called the Visible Identification Standards for Immigration-Based Law Enforcement, aka VISIBLE. The act would require DHS personnel, including ICE agents, Customs and Border Protection, CPB, and federal agents detailed to immigration operations, to show their clearly legible identification, including their agency name or initials, and either their name or badge number. The act requires that this information is clearly visible and unobscured by tactical gear or clothing. It would also prohibit non-medical face coverings such as a mask or balaclavas, which can obscure or conceal identity. There are some exceptions for environmental hazards and covert operations. The act also requires DHS to establish disciplinary measures for violations and to provide a report to Congress on compliance, as well as investigate complaints through its Office for Civil Rights and Civil Liberties Department. The bill does not apply to covert or non-public operations. The legislation is led by Wyden, Democratic Senators Cory Booker of New Jersey, and Alex Padilla of California. The bill is endorsed by ACLU and Public Counsel. The 2025 school year is set to start in just a few weeks. A coalition of 24 states and the District of Columbia have sued the Trump administration regarding the administration's decision to freeze more than $6 billion in federal education grants for K-12 schools and adult education. The move, announced late yesterday, comes 2 weeks after the Trump administration first notified states that it is withholding previously approved funds. Shortly after a funding freeze of billions of dollars was initially announced, two Democratic lawmakers from Arizona, Senator Mark Kelly and Representative Greg Stanton, urged Trump to release the funds as soon as possible. Their states have a particularly early start in the school year. In one district, classes begin on July 16th. They write, quote, "This freeze is putting Arizona school districts in an impossible financial situation, as school districts have already adopted their annual budgets and signed contracts for the upcoming school year," end quote. More than 100 House Democrats wrote to the administration asking that the funds be released immediately. Even some Republican lawmakers pushed back on the freeze. Senator Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine, said, quote, "I strongly oppose the administration's decision to pause the delivery of education formula grant funding to states and local school districts across the country. The administration should release these funds without any further delay," end quote. The frozen funds include grants for a wide range of programs, including migrant education, before and after school programs, and services for English language learners. The largest chunk of grant money consists of roughly $2.2 billion for professional development for educators. It's not the first time the Trump administration has gone after these programs. Earlier this spring, it said it would stop paying out $1 billion in grant funding for school mental health programs and training. 16 states, including New York and Wisconsin, have sued the Education Department over that decision. Other states that joined yesterday's lawsuit include New York, Colorado, Massachusetts, Arizona, Kentucky, and Pennsylvania. The U.S. Education Department, one of the defendants named in the suit, has not yet commented. Trump threatens Russia with secondary sanctions, Some of the president's allies want him to fire Federal Reserve Chair, and farmers and doctors worry about impact of budget cuts on rural communities. With that story and more, it's Zimon Perez with 2025 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I've been hearing so much talk. It's all talk. It's all talk, and then missiles go into Kiev and kill 60 people. It's got to stop.
President Donald Trump is giving Russian President Vladimir Putin 50 days to reach a ceasefire deal with Ukraine under threat of what Trump calls biting tariffs. Direct U.S. trade with Russia is negligible, so to have any effect, Trump's threatened 100% import tariffs would have to be secondary, imposed on people who themselves trade with Russia. Trump also announced the weapons deal Sunday, providing NATO allies with munitions, including highly sought-after Patriot air defense missiles. The U.S. will sell weapons to European allies, who could send them to Ukraine. NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte joined the president at the White House.
It might also mean that countries will move equipment fast into Ukraine, and then the U.S. later backfilling it because speed is of the essence here.
Trump's 180 on Putin comes just 5 months after a public spat with Ukraine's president. Some in the administration are calling on the president to fire Fed Chair Jerome Powell, citing cost overruns and renovation of the Fed headquarters. Market watchers warn that could crash the market. They also credit Powell with managing a soft landing, which no other central banker has ever done, bringing down surging inflation without causing unemployment to spike. Some rural physicians say they're alarmed by Medicaid cuts in the just-signed budget law. Small-town Virginia doctor Sterling Ranson says without the coverage, his patients will put off preventative care, and some will die.
They don't do their preventive health care services, such as mammography. They don't get their colonoscopies, and it puts them at greater risk of developing a lot of chronic diseases, cancers, things like that, that we could have found earlier before they became a problem.
Researchers at the University of North Carolina found more than 300 rural hospitals nationwide would be at risk of closing without patients whose bills would be paid by the program. Farmers also say they're worried about the $300 billion cut from food programs, typically part of the farm bill. And while Walter Schweitzer with the Montana Farmers Union says he likes changes to commodity price supports, he dislikes that the program is no longer going to be means tested.
Increasing the reference price is a good thing. This is something Farmers Union has been advocating for. But what concerns me is by eliminating the adjusted gross income cap means now Bill Gates qualifies for all of these subsidies.
Schweitzer also says delaying unpopular parts of the legislation from going into effect until after the midterms is a red flag. Attorneys general from 24 states in the District of Columbia are suing the administration over $6.8 billion in education funding that the administration is withholding. This comes as the Supreme Court has ruled the White House could move ahead with the firing of 1,400 Department of Education employees, essentially dismantling the agency. I'm Zimon Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
Hey, how are you? Well, they're two.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in depth. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be a high of 92 and a low of 65. And tomorrow we're going to have a high of 97 and a low of 59. It's going to be hot, hot, hot. Hydration is key in these times. Today in history, in 1903, Ford Motor Company took its first order. The Ford Company is credited with developing the assembly line production model that has taken capitalist America by storm. It is a system designed to make most product possible while making workers dispensable. 122 years later, fast food restaurants and production lines all over the country use the Ford assembly line. The quote of the day is from John Holloway in his book, Crack Capitalism. He said, quote, "Comradeship, dignity, amorosity, love, solidarity, fraternity, friendship, ethics, all these names stand in contrast to the commodified, monetized relations of capitalism. All described relations developed in struggles against capitalism and which can be seen as anticipating or creating a society beyond capitalism," end quote. The Trump administration may be reviving plans for a controversial mine upstream from Alaska's Bristol Bay. With that story and more, it's Antonio Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonio Gonzalez. The Trump administration may be on the verge of reviving plans for a controversial mine upstream from Alaska's Bristol Bay. The company behind the proposed pebble mine says it's in talks with the Environmental Protection Agency and hopes the agency will withdraw its veto of the project. The open-pit copper and gold mine is widely opposed by area tribes and the Bristol Bay Native Corporation, as well as commercial fishermen. They say it's a threat to the bay's prolific salmon runs that are the basis of the regional economy and vital to subsistence and Alaska Native culture. Environmental studies found the mine would damage or destroy miles of salmon streams and more than 2,000 acres of wetlands. Opponents have succeeded in blocking the proposal for decades. The EPA issued a rare veto of the project in 2023, but a document filed in federal court this month reveals the EPA is reconsidering that decision. In his first term, President Trump ran hot and cold on Pebble. His first EPA administrator let the project move forward, then reversed course a few months later. In 2020, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers denied Pebble's Clean Water Act permit. That came after Donald Trump Jr., a sports fisherman who visited the region, publicly announced his opposition. The Trump administration's new budget reconciliation bill is drawing criticism from some for its cuts to social safety net programs. But residents in one Arctic community say the bill will support their economy thanks to several carve-outs for Alaska, including an increased tax break for whaling captains. Ayolna Naiden with the Alaska Desk has more.
Charles Achlanik Lampy is an Inupiaq whaler, born and raised in Kaktovik on the North Slope. His whaling crew hosted a feast in June, celebrating their successful bowhead whale harvest and sharing it with the village.
It doesn't only go to the whaling captains or whaling captains' families. It goes to our entire community.
Lampy is one of the whaling captains in Alaska's Arctic who are applauding the Republican mega bill that President Trump signed into law on July 4th. The bill has been criticized for extending tax breaks for wealthy Americans and for slashing social safety net programs like Medicaid and food stamps. The final bill also includes a tax deduction increase for subsistence whaling captains from $10,000 to $50,000 for whaling-related expenses. Lampy says those deductions will provide a big economic relief for 11 whaling communities in Alaska. He says captains like him annually need to buy fuel, food, whaling bombs, and safety gear for their crews.
It could be very, very spendy. Being able to have that tax break, you know, frees up money to provide help for the rest of the year for not only the whaling captains, but to our family members and stuff too, because we help wherever we can.
The mega bill also seeks to increase resource development across the state and includes new oil lease sales in the National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska and the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Nathan Gordon Jr. is the mayor of Kaktovik, the only community within the refuge. He says those provisions acknowledge what many North Slope residents have been advocating for: responsible resource development to support local economy and infrastructure.
That's where most of the tax money is going to go, is to the new school in Kaktovik, which is amazing.
I am Alona Naiden.
Representative Sharice Davids and colleagues are calling on the Department of Justice to restore the Not Invisible Act Commission report to the DOJ website, which was removed earlier this year due to an executive order. Members recently sent a letter to the DOJ saying the report includes critical information on the missing and murdered Indigenous persons crisis and say its removal erases years of research. Members say accessible data is essential to addressing the crisis and are asking the DOJ to take steps to immediately restore it. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The seventh annual While You Were Streaming report from the nonprofit Truth Initiative finds that while e-cigarette use is down among youth, millions are still exposed to vaping or smoking in the media. Suzanne Potter has more on the story.
Hundreds of millions of American young people are exposed to vaping and smoking in popular movies, TV shows, and music videos each year, according to the seventh annual While You Were Streaming report from the nonprofit Truth Initiative. Tobacco depictions are down in the most popular Hollywood shows, but they are heavily featured in programs like The Bear, Euphoria, and Stranger Things. Jessica Rath with Truth Initiative says youth and young adults are three times more likely to start vaping when exposed to tobacco imagery in shows.
Animated shows remain a consistent offender. 5 out of 6 of the top 15 animated shows contain tobacco depictions, and those are more popular with Gen Z than any other demographic.
The report found that in 2023, 70% of binge-watched streaming shows contained tobacco imagery, a 6% increase from the year before. Shows that fueled that increase include American Dad, Law & Order SVU, Never Have I Ever, and South Park. Rath says her organization is working with entertainment companies and state attorneys general to get information added before or after the shows, like you might see for suicide prevention.
Companies can run advertisements with tested prevention messaging or quitline resources up in the top corner when the content that they're showing contains tobacco.
The good news is that youth vaping is actually at its lowest rate in a decade, but smoking in entertainment threatens to reverse that progress. Truth Initiative developed a free resource to help people quit. Just text XPROGRAM to 88709. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
DC's smart bins offer 24-hour food waste drop-off. The rat-proof bins are making composting easier for city residents. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. New waste bins in Washington, D.C. are helping to fight climate change. This year, D.C. installed about 30 smart bins on sidewalks across the city, where people can drop off food waste like table scraps. When food waste breaks down in a landfill, it produces methane, a powerful planet-warming gas. But the waste in these bins goes to a facility to become compost instead. The smart bins are rat-proof and can be opened with a keypad code or an app that also tells people which items are compostable. Just 8 weeks after installation, the new bins had collected 65,000 pounds of food waste.
From 0 to 65,000 pounds, that's incredible.
John Johnson of the D.C. Department of Public Works says the smart bins are part of a citywide effort to keep waste out of landfills. Residents can also dispose of food waste at drop-off events, and some homes and small apartment buildings have food waste picked up curbside. But the new bins give anyone a way to compost 24/7.
This gives residents more of an opportunity, particularly those that live in multifamily buildings.
He says the smart bins have been so successful that the city is looking at expanding the program to keep even more food waste out of landfills. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Rick Smith presents This Day, July 15th, in 1959 labor history. 500,000 steelworkers worked off the job in the longest and last strike of the industry. Rick Smith has more.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1959. That was the day 500,000 steelworkers walked off the job in a historic 116-day strike in defense of work rules. It was the largest industry-wide strike. It was also the last. The strike affected 12 steel companies and shut down more than 85% of steel production. Mill owners refused to grant wage increases unless the union agreed to changes in the contract. Specifically, they were looking to eliminate Section 2B, titled Local Working Conditions. The bosses wanted the ability to change the number of workers assigned to any given task. They also wanted to introduce new machinery and rules that would reduce labor hours and cut the workforce. United Steelworker members understood this as an assault on workplace safety and a move to break the union. Mill bosses hoped that a long strike would provoke the membership to abandon their union. But according to Jack Metzger, author of Striking Steel, members had grown used to walkouts every 3 years and planned accordingly. As well, the United Steelworkers had a well-oiled machinery, including an internal welfare system for hardship cases, and also reached out to merchants, banks, charitable agencies, and local and state governments to organize relief. By the end of August, the Department of Defense stoked anxieties that national security was at risk. 3 months into the strike, union funds dwindled and strikers felt the pinch. President Eisenhower invoked a Taft-Hartley injunction, hoping to force strikers back to work. As the union rose to challenge Taft-Hartley's constitutionality, solidarity among the mill owners crumbled. Kaiser Steel broke ranks and settled separately. Their contract granted wage increases and preserved Section 2B, which set the precedent for the contract that was eventually signed industry-wide.
Today on Good News, Good Planet, would you ride your bike more if you got paid to do it? Mandy Stapleford has more.
Good news, good planet, good news.
It's time now for your good news for a good planet. Bucks for bike rides. Would you ride your bike more if you got paid to do it? That's the idea behind Denver, Colorado's Bicycling Rewards Program, a collaborative effort between Denver's Office of Climate Action and Denver Streets Partnership. The pilot program comes in response to the city's struggle to meet climate goals. Over 30% of Denver's emissions come from commuting. The Bicycle Rewards Program aims to reduce emissions by encouraging bike riding during warmer months. It offers three different reward tracks: mileage reimbursement, wraparound support, or a combination of the two. Participants in the mileage reimbursement track can get paid $1 for every mile they bike instead of drive, up to $200 a month. The wraparound support track offers bicycle training, personalized coaching, and up to $500 for bike gear or repairs, plus a $200 bonus at the end of the pilot program. The combo track offers the best of both. The program is open to any Denver resident over the age of 18 who currently drives to work. Participants track all destination trips taken by bicycle between April through June using their smartphones. It's also targeting historically underinvested communities, people of color, and those with lower incomes. By incentivizing bike riding, Denver's reward program encourages commuters to make choices that are healthier for themselves and the planet. And this is Mandy from GoodNewsGoodPlanet.com.
Undiplomatic language is costly in foreign relations, and Trump is a master of it. His recent exchanges with the presidents of Brazil and Liberia, threatening the former and condescendingly complimenting the latter, show a U.S. president who is the country's worst diplomat. We now go to global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. How the leader of the world's most powerful country conducts affairs of state can have lasting consequences for U.S. foreign policy. Language is important, not just slip-ups, but disrespectful, inappropriate words and intentionally false statements can cause immense harm. President Trump is a master of all of them. His off-the-cuff speeches are meanderings, pointless and bewildering, and often hateful. And how he mangles the language. His social media posts are typically filled with capital letters and poor grammar. All these traits were on display when Trump, in a direct interference in Brazil's politics, notified its government of a 50% tariff on all Brazilian goods. The Brazilians must have had a good laugh over Trump's language, though the reason he wrote is not at all laughable. He was retaliating for Brazil's trial of Jair Bolsonaro, a Trump far-right favorite. Bolsonaro is the coup leader whom President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva defeated in the 2022 election. You can see the letter for yourself online. I counted over 50 words that were incorrectly capitalized. For example, referring to Bolsonaro as a highly respected leader, all capitalized, throughout the world, capitalized, during his term, capitalized. Then there are run-on sentences to go with undiplomatic language, distortion of facts, and a silly closing line. Quote, "You will never be disappointed with the United States of America." Seventh grade English students here would have a field day correcting the letter. Lula has responded forcefully to Trump, and in excellent English. It said, "Brazil is a sovereign nation with independent institutions and will not accept any form of tutelage. The judicial proceedings against those responsible for planning the coup fall exclusively under the jurisdiction of Brazil's judicial branch, and as such are not subject to any interference or threats that could compromise the independence of national institutions." The claim regarding a U.S. trade deficit in its commercial relations with Brazil is inaccurate. Statistics from the U.S. government itself show a surplus of $410 billion in the trade of goods and services with Brazil over the past 15 years. Therefore, any unilateral tariff increases will be addressed in accordance with Brazil's economic reciprocity law. Sovereignty, respect, and the unwavering defense of the interests of the Brazilian people are the values that guide our relationship with the world. Part of that letter makes reference to Brazil's regulations regarding hate speech on digital platforms. In the context of digital platforms, the letter says, Brazilian society rejects hateful content, racism, child pornography, scams, fraud, and speeches against human rights and democratic freedom. In Brazil, freedom of expression must not be confused with aggression or violent practices. The letter says that all companies operating in Brazil must comply with Brazilian law. Behind that statement is another dispute with Trump, a lawsuit by his social media company against Brazilian Supreme Federal Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes, who has suspended various social media accounts, at one time including Elon Musk's X, and censored a conservative commentator for hate speech. Justice de Moraes, a well-known critic of the Brazilian far right, will sit in judgment of Bolsonaro. Leave it to Trump to defend hate speech abroad. The language issue popped up in the White House again the other day when the heads of four African nations gathered there. They listened to Trump praise Liberia's president for his English. "Such good English," said Trump to President Joseph Boakai. "Where did you learn to speak so beautifully? Where were you educated? Where? In Liberia?" Trump just couldn't let go. English has, in fact, been the official language of Liberia ever since the country's founding by escaped and freed slaves in 1822. And here's Trump, obviously knowing nothing about the country, embarrassing himself and his guest with that compliment. A Liberian opposition politician said Trump's comments were condescending and showed disrespect for Africans. Boakai's office was kinder, saying Trump's appreciation of the president's English was a good thing. But President Boakai was obviously forced to bite his tongue in view of Liberia's dependence on the U.S. Trump's dissolution of USAID is badly hurting Liberia, which relies heavily on U.S. public aid, health aid. The U.S. tariff increases add to Liberia's burden. The common lesson of the Brazil and Liberia exchanges is that they have harmed U.S. relations, not only with those countries, but probably also with Latin America and Africa generally. Diplomacy based on threats and conducted with disrespect are bound to lead those on the receiving end to look for alternatives. You can be sure that China will be the chief beneficiary. Beijing is already Brazil's and Africa's primary trade partner. Trump has left the field open to further Chinese influence. I'm Mel Gertow for the Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.